And exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 494, and it's May 24th, 1981. There's three Geminis sitting in this room this evening. I don't know how the show's going to go. Two good friends, and that makes three of us in one room, and that's a lot of energy. A very sad story on the air coming over here this evening at the news before I came to the station. The president of Ecuador was killed in an airplane crash with his wife and members of the cabinet. This is the first Democratic elected official in 8 years. Military junta until then. He's been in power since August 79. That's about a year and a few months, which is pretty good for a Democrat in South America. Being as we're getting ready for a bloodbath in all of Central America, it is one more tragic event to pile up to many other tragic events. It reminds me of a broadcast I did in KLRB several years ago called The Serpent's Egg, movie made by Ingmar Bergman, about watching this dangerous snake grow in a sack with the visibility of it as it kept getting larger and larger. The movie was made in Nazi Germany in 1922, and the serpent keeps growing and growing. The serpent is sprouting now all over the world, and events will get worse and worse at a very fast scale, and it's going to be hard to keep up with them. There's more than I can put on this program 1 hour a week, so I just do the best I can. I had a busy week before I get into some of this material. I had my third telephone call from Marina Oswald, and I was quite flattered. She said, after 17 years in this country and being told lies by many people, I was practically the only person in the United States she trusted. I never believed that would come from Marina Oswald. I've studied everything that she testified or did in the past years, and I knew Marguerite Oswald. But Marina knows that those people who were her friends are her enemies. The people that said they would help her didn't. People that say they're telling the truth lied to her. And she's called me three times, and I've been very honest with her. She's upset about the grave not being opened. She knows that her husband isn't in that grave. They made her sign a piece of paper to have the body moved. And then when she spoke better English after that episode, that was right in January of 1964, before there was a single witness, before the Warren Commission or before Jack Ruby's trial on killing this particular person, Lee Harvey Oswald. And she signed a piece of paper and then learned later that this body had been cremated and she doesn't believe it was Lee. And whether it was the person who shot the president or didn't shoot the president, as a widow, remarried and with his children, she feels she has a right to know. And she called me and asked me to ask people to raise money, a large amount of money, to exhume the body herself. I think the figure would be about $12,000. And I said, if I asked everyone that I could on radio programs to raise a dollar each and reach that many people, if we came up with $12,000, then the government would come in and say, well, if you're going to do it, we'll do it. So we may as well ask them to do it in the first place. They'll just take our money and do it if they see it has to be done. And because in Volume 5 of the Warren Commission hearings, it was Gerald Ford who made J. Edgar Hoover swear that the case was open for all time, I think the logical thing is to pursue this. And if indeed that grave is empty, which I know it is empty, we go from point one and ask Gerald Ford, who was on the Warren Commission, who's now on the board of directors of every major corporation that he can reap his millions in, just why he sat at meetings and had the body cremated. That would be a good place to start, I believe. But anyway, I was flattered that she called and that she trusted me, and I pass on the message to you. I'm also attending the Russell Little trial as many days as I can during the week in Salinas. He was charged with killing Dr. Marcus Foster. That murder was in November of 73, and then the SLA kidnapped Patty Hearst afterwards in February of 74. And in the interim, he was very much a part of the people who killed Dr. Foster. He claims he didn't, but was in the room with the people that he said did kill Dr. Foster. And it's an interesting trial. The prosecution attorney asked, well, why didn't you call the police or get away from these people if they claimed they were murderers? Why were you associating with them? And he said, well, they told me they were sorry. They made a mistake. So therefore, I decided to become part of their group. It's a trial that I'll discuss more when it's over, but because the jury is out and home and this does reach the Salinas area, I don't think I should go into it now. And one other matter I do want to share with you, I'm very proud of several letters I've gotten in the period of years of radio work. This is my 10th year. One in particular, I got a letter this week. It was written by Fletcher Prouty. He was chief liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA for many, many years. He was familiar with Alexander Haig and General Lansdale and James McCord and the U-2 efforts, and he was very much a part of the inside of the system, and he shares correspondence with Charles Spears. And probably Charles and Fletcher are two of the most renowned people of American history that I can mention, knowing most of the facts and circumstances of what makes the world turn around this part of the world, the United States, and our overseas relationships, too. And evidently, Charles shares a lot of material with Fletcher, and I do get letters from him from time to time. He shares the tapes and the sheets that go with my research and tells him what I'm doing each week and sharing with you. And I want to read a paragraph from this letter because sometimes people ask me, you know, what is your credibility or how do you think it rates? And the only way I can rate it is by my own peer group, by people who know more than me. Their opinion or criticism is the only thing that I really think is valid. People that aren't reading the work or doing it or experiencing it, I don't care what they think or say because they haven't done the work. But this is what Fletcher wrote to Charles Spears, and I'm going to share it with you. He said, "May certainly turns out good stuff. I wish I had the time to work with her. With her fabulous research and priceless intuition, she is right 95% of the time." This is pretty good from the man who wrote The Secret Team, a well-accepted book by all the researchers in the country. "It happens I could usually close that 5% gap. She does great with the big time that is essential to make sense to of all... She says she does great work. She has not had the experience right nose to nose with the big time that is essential to make sense of all the things she knows. She knows a lot more than she believes she does. I doubt that. She is like a magnificent picture in a slide projector. It is not quite in focus. It needs someone to turn it ever so little, and all will be brilliant." That 5% he got working years and years in the Pentagon and with the CIA. But I'm very flattered. I think if he said that 20% of it was right, I may take him on with that. But I'm really flattered about that because this is a person I respect and I appreciate the words he said. And maybe that will give you some confidence if you're shaking your heads out there some evenings to sit back and read The Secret Team, read his book, and listen carefully week after week and begin to see what he says is true and what I feel I know is true. I'm only going to do a few sentences or remarks about the shootout at the Old Corral at the Hilton Hotel because I want to get right on to the second part of who shot Pope John Paul II. I want to mention the fact that Ronald Reagan asked the people in the Pentagon not to refer to Alexander Haig anymore. I heard it on Good Morning America this week. Mr. Benjamin Civiletti was talking about leaks from the Pentagon and said after the shooting, Ronald Reagan gave orders, don't talk about Alexander Haig anymore. So evidently, Reagan got both the message and the bullet. He announced that he's going to take a month-long vacation, which is scandalous with the international and national situations going all over the world and the terrible appointments he's making and the controversies. But again, he can turn his back and go away for a month, and then half days when he gets back, Bush and Haig did very well. He's asked that we don't refer to the assassination attempt as an assassination. Jody Jacobs wrote in the LA Times, we're to call it an episode. This is more of his Disneyland fantasy. Reality isn't reality, and he just went through an episode. I'm sure that poor Press Secretary Brady doesn't think it's an episode. He just got wheeled out in the hall for his big treat after 4 weeks, left with a half a brain and two other people badly injured, but we're to refer to it as an episode. And finally, there was a newscast on a radio program this week that John Hinckley Jr. may be set free next week. I read you part of a Wall Street Journal article 2 weeks ago. Hinckley could be free by the ruling that he's no danger to himself or others. This was in the Wall Street Journal, and they have announced that John Hinckley Jr. may be on his feet and out, totally free, home free, pretty disgusting, you have to agree. I'm glad I did the three-part, and I'll do more about the Reagan shooting and the links of the Hinckley family to the CIA and the Defense Department. The way they're hushing this up is absolutely scandalous, and I'm glad for those of you who were too young to remember the investigations of the John Kennedy assassination or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King, that you're able to see now for yourself what happens when four people are gunned down on a street and one of them is the president and another one is suffering so terribly, and this fellow is airlifted to a cozy little hospital and they may spring the door open. Now to get to the matter of who killed John Paul II, I listed very many motives last week, possible motives, and I'm going to talk about one in particular this week. I ruled out the Muslim versus Christian motive, and probably next week I'll go into the Protestant versus Catholic and the strong religious war with the fundamentalists from the South and the Hinckley gang down in Dallas-Fort Worth and throughout the whole South versus the Catholic religion, the Carl McIntyre gang. And then I'm going into the drug war that I've talked about, the United States policy towards Turkey, which isn't separate from the narcotic war of cutting off the opium from 71, 72, and holding back the profit of the agriculture people who wanted to grow it in Turkey and the rebellion of the younger people with the right to have opium. But the means of growing opium is the money for the weapons and the far right. And they'll be growing more opium, I believe, as the far right gets more muscles in Turkey, unless NATO and Reagan and Haig can sit on them and stop it in order to keep their market free for Colombia, Bolivia, and their own little gang of narcotics traffic. That is really the essence of the struggle in the White House, is who is on top and who controls the drug market. But tonight I mostly want to go into the motive of the fascist, and it isn't separated from the drug traffic link, the fascist element that is behind the shooting of John Paul II. And again, it won't be far away from what happened in Ecuador this evening. The media is something that should be studied. A person could really get a doctor's degree in the way the media is suffering through the agony of the evidence that this Muhammad Ali Aja is part of the far, far right wing. And the right wing, as I will go into, goes all the way to Germany and German banks and to San Diego, California, United States of America. It is an international group, but they are holding it back as long as they can, even though it's breaking in some papers like the New York Times, not the Washington Post yet. The best example of newspaper coverage of assassination evidence comes from William Randolph Hearst. He's a subject for many dissertations. Last week in his Examiner Chronicle edition of May the 17th, he talked about a briefing in Washington with the top CIA officials and Alexander Haig and so forth. Then he got into his discussion and analysis of who shot the Pope. He said in the editorial of the San Francisco Chronicle, and he controls the paper, the man who shot the Pope was acting alone. He said, I'll bet the Turkish fanatic was probably acting on his own. This guy had the look of a loner. In fact, said Randolph Hearst Jr., he reminded me of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, who kidnapped and killed the Lindbergh baby in 1932, and he looked like Lee Harvey Oswald, who assassinated President Kennedy in 1963. Well, he was wrong about all three, but that's the kind of editorial that just keeps going on and on, even though all three of the instances he talks about were larger conspiracies. And then you take Newsweek, owned by Washington Post, and they write a long dissertation on John Paul II and Aja and his interconnecting links and his money and his funding. And then they have a picture, his mother with her head bowed, this pathetic mother who could be Sir Anne's mother or Marguerite Oswald with a hood on, and it says his mother, a bit funny in the head, quotations. Yeah, the real thing, she said, was that when he was 4 years old, he fell on the floor and was in a stupor and act funny in the head. But suddenly he got a lot of money and went to the university where he learned three languages. And when he killed a publisher in Turkey, she was getting $3,000, $4,000 checks deposited in her bank account, and international bankers were funding his mother. I wish my kids were that funny in the head. I could get $3,000 or $4,000 every few weeks from them. She looked so pathetic. But then they conclude the article, and this is typical of the way Time and Newsweek do things. They say there's still a lot of unanswered questions. That's true. This is page 38 of Newsweek about the methodical, soft-spoken Turk, and many of them will never be fully answered. They decide that within 5 days of the shooting. In a sense, the most important questions were answered right away, and they had to do with what Aja was not. Now, they said he wasn't Italian, so the Red Brigades were glad. He was an Irish, so the IRS were off the hook, and he wasn't Muslim. Therefore, the world trembled at what he might turn out to be, but the truth appeared that he was simply a terrorist without a cause. This terrorist without a cause was let out of a Turkish jail with 2,000 other killers. They have a record of hundreds of deaths all over the world and were used as trained hitmen. He traveled around in Europe with a $100-a-day budget and tours and 2 weeks in London and three in Mallorca. And lush hotels, and women secreted at other places. I'll go into that. This was a terrorist without a cause. Well, for no reason at all, and this is what they want you to believe, he just simply was on his own living it up, you know, to the hilt. And the New York Times, this is typical. I'm giving you just three cross-sections because we could do a lot more. Like the Hearst Syndicate, their paper, the Newsweek, the New York Times, Mr. Apple Jr. He is doing terrible articles, but there are some good writers coming out of the New York Times. He admits the investigation is stalled, that Interpol is very limited. The authorities are looking into the past 12 months of Aja. But then the writer says, maybe he is an isolated nut, they have a quotation, or maybe he was supported only by a small group of Turkish right-wing and not part of international network of terrorists. Now, that is pathetic because the New York Times knew by the 8th that this was not true. And they were pushing, 18th rather, the shooting was on the 13th. And they're pushing this, well, if it has to be a group, it's a small group. That's what that Claire Sterling said, wrote the book on the terrorists. If we're going to have a conspiracy, we'll have a little tiny conspiracy and not a big one. Now, the truth of the fact is that many countries are going into a right-wing push now as fast as they can. It may not work. The Spanish monarchy are back in swing tonight. There was a bank and people were taken hostage. The man who tried the military coup, according to the New York Times, is a hero. He's a leader of the people in Spain. They're rendering homage to him. He's their most celebrated prisoner. And Colonel Tejero Molina is considered a folk hero among the Spanish ultra-right. The fact that they didn't successfully get him to Argentina, that they wanted to do when they took the bank, doesn't mean the intent isn't there again. Many people want him in power. They don't want the monarchy. They want Franco's group to come right back into power. He's in a prison right outside the same city where Franco was born, and he sees 30 and 40 people a day, and he's holding court. Maybe he won't have so much freedom after this latest attempt this weekend to take that bank. But the fascists are very much in power in every single country around the world, and that's why it's so hard to get information about this case, because Interpol and the interconnecting links of the Nazis in Germany and Frankfurt are linked directly to Muhammad Ali Aja's party, and this is also coming out in the news. Turkey is about to indict 230 people. And Aja is a part of that group. And the Turkish government has a trial that's been, the material's been put together for the last 7 months. And there's a large 945-page indictment of the Turkey Nationalist Action Party. And there are links to Western Europe, and I'm going into some of those. They're charging this group of people, 230 people, with the murder of 694 people, specifically in Turkey. They said there is a widespread network controlled by a particular group that do want a military junta in Turkey. And this network, as I said, goes all the way around the world to South America, to Europe, San Diego, California, and the United States of America. They're preparing this prosecution, and the prosecution was in the offing long before the shooting of John Paul II, and it's interesting that they used an agent directly linked to this trial, and all the information about him was available that they used him for the shooting of the Pope, or maybe they hoped that he would be shot on sight and would not link them to the international terrorist organization. There was a word that came out from Turkey, if you see him, shoot him on sight, and that would silence his role to the larger organization that he's trying to disassociate himself from. Now, the group are charged with the murder of 694 people. I think that's interesting, and there's a parallel here to what's happening in the United States, but people aren't ready to accept that yet. And that is that I could name 230 people, it's just about that many, that have been in charge of overthrowing this country since the end of World War II, since 1945, when they brought Hitler's Reinhard Gehlen into this country to form the National Security Council and the CIA. And I think I could list 694 people they have murdered. You could just take 45 on the airplane with Dorothy Hunt, or 35 major witnesses to Watergate, or 150 witnesses to the John Kennedy assassination. But I'm talking about judges, rock musicians. There are people, professional life, civil rights leaders, and in my files, I have political prisoners, and I could give easily 694 people that have been murdered by 230 far-rightists in this country. And in order to solve these problems someday, we're going to have as much bloodshed in Turkey, which was about 5,000 deaths before they came to this indictment of these people. But this country hasn't seen enough blood flow. They're just trickling down Atlanta. They found their 28th today and 914 in Jonestown. But the streets really have to get bloody. There isn't going to be any way out before the American people see it. And when they are fighting and bleeding at both ends, and really don't have enough to get around under a condition like Turkey clawing for one-upsmanship and killing most of the leaders of this country so that the young people are left leaderless and kill each other, when that happens, there will be a list that people like Charles Spears and myself and other researchers have. We could tomorrow say Jacques Hughes to 230 people and give you 694 that are dead. And that is the ratio that is happening in this country. And in the Turkish government, they have this list of people that they're going into the Nationalist Action Party, and they are making interconnecting links to various countries. Now, most of the radical people from Turkey have moved to West Germany. There's a network of 129, what they call the Idealist Association, and they moved into West Germany, and they're part of a larger umbrella group called the Democratic Idealist Turkish Association Federation in Europe. And that group has a million Turkish workers and family in West Germany, but they're also a place it is for the killers or the assassination teams to have safe refuge and go all over the world. So eventually, say, one member out of those gangs of killers can be at St. Peter's and shoot the Pope. And we'll go into the motives in more detail as I go on, but I want to get the facts of the organizations that Muhammad Ali Aja comes from. Now, this group has links in Belgium, in Netherlands, in France, in Austria, in Switzerland. Of course, his gun went from Belgium to Switzerland to Austria to a train station in Rome. And these interconnecting links are more like the Permandex group, the assassination teams that were set up with Nazis also in Chile and South America and Mexico behind the murder of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, or Orlando Letelier and Sandra Moffat. This gang is a Western Europe hit squad that has been in operation since World War II. Has nothing to do with the Syria Habash gang. I thought it did at first because when he was arrested, he used the names Chile and George Habash, and somebody from the New York Times was writing that it was linked, or Washington Post, to Gaddafi. But it seems that this group of neo-Nazis and Nazis are directly linked to the stormtroopers of Adolf Hitler and the assassination teams that have worked out of these various countries. Aja was in London 2 weeks, and he was also in Brussels and Switzerland, Greece, and many other places that the first articles about him didn't contain. The indictment against these people, including Aja, says that they are associated throughout all of Europe. They are a clandestine right-wing group, and the organization has been very active since 1969 in getting together its muscles for takeover of various countries. They have money in banks in West Germany. This is from the New York, one article in the New York Times. And the indictment that's listed provides the details of their party's finances and documents of bank accounts in West Germany. And remember, it was Germany and London that funded the starting of Jonestown and experiments on people over there. Now, one of the people linked in this indictment to this particular operation, this Nazi group that he works with, had American Express cards and savings accounts in the San Diego Trust Savings Bank. And funds were coming from there. And the United States leader is a Walter Perfisch, P-F-E-R-S-I-C-H, Jr. He has a title, the leader of the National Fascist Party in America, and is linked to that through his money in San Diego, in California, and he operates in the United States. This group are waiting for a Fuhrer or a Hitler to arrive, a Mr. Turks. He refers to himself as Baz Bug, B-A-S-B-U-G, is the leader of the Turkish party, the most violent group of Turkish radicals that Aja belongs to, and the policeman that let him out of the jail in a military uniform belongs to that group, as the people who gave him passport pictures and so forth and provided his funding. The leader, Mr. Turks, refers to himself as B-A-S-B-U-G, Baz Bug, the equivalent of the Fuhrer. And as I say, their money is in West German banks. Now, the Nationalist Action Party in Turkey, according to the New York Times, has links with the West German Secret Service, with a member of the Gestapo, the Secret Service, and officer, Dr. Mehmet Kengerli. There was correspondence that was obtained of these people writing to West Germany, and in there were the names of West German intelligence contacts that the Turkish far-right Nazi group were working with. There are Nazi militants with strong connections, not only in Germany, but around the world, directly linked to these Turkish right-wing people that want to take control of the Turkish government. Another associate of this Aja, his name is Selçuk, C-E-L-C-U-K, part of the Nationalist Action Party. He was arrested just recently, and he helped Aja escape from Turkey to go to Iran last year. An interesting thing, they disguised him as a smuggler. And as I say, the heroin business is going good from Iran to Turkey to West Germany. That is the way these groups fund each other. And when Jimmy Carter was president, I talked about the narcotic war between the Nixon-Reagan gang as against the Atlanta-Georgia-Carter narcotics traffic. When the Shah of Iran was removed from office and Khomeini came in, the opium began to grow again. The traffic was going through Turkey and into Germany, and they were in a great big business boom that has increased in this country many times over. And maybe next week we'll do the narcotics connections, and I'll give you the dates of these articles and the flow of the traffic. But it is the narcotics money that funds these people and buys them the weapons and gives them the power to travel. They don't have a endless budget, but narcotics is pretty good. The season grows and the poppies keep coming, and so they don't have any trouble of funding weapons as long as they can grow some poppies. Now, some of the editorials this week, along with these articles on the right-wing links of the gray wolves, the werewolves, and I'll talk about Hitler's youth and the youth movements in Turkey and the parallels of that. The editorials are still trying to find motives. The San Jose Mercury had a story 1 week after the assassination on the attempt on the Pope. There's no motive, no solid information. The investigators are more baffled than ever. How did he get around? Who did he know? They said he's not crazy. They said he's not schizophrenic. He's well paid. They can't figure him out, but he isn't bowing or groveling. He's a different kind of an assassin. Up till now, we've used front guys that were our patsies, and the trained gunman got away. This time, they got a real mean gunman who's done a lot of work, who's very cool under interrogation and seems to be enjoying the attention, who is totally confusing the world and has his rockers about him like John Hinckley Jr. And the right wing is holding the press at arm's distance and saying, I dare you to say who we belong to, you know, you'll offbeat the balance of national security if you admit that we're all in power together. So the news media is having trouble handling this information, and I'll do some more about Aja in a minute. This is the end of the first 30 minutes, and it's Mae Brussel in Carmel. I'll be back with you in 1 minute.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.